From NPR News, this is a special report, hearings on Elena Kagan's nomination to serve on the Supreme Court. I'm Linda Wertheimer. When Elena Kagan sat down before the Senate Judiciary Committee today, she was only the fourth woman ever to face confirmation to be on the Supreme Court. She currently works in the Obama administration as the Solicitor General of the United States. That is the government's lawyer in the Supreme Court. She's the first woman ever to hold that job. And when she argued her first case as Solicitor General, it was also the first time Elena Kagan appeared as an advocate in any court. She clerked at the Supreme Court for Justice Thurgood Marshall, but her career in the law has been mostly academic. She was the first woman to serve as the dean of Harvard Law School, and her career has been political. She served as legal and political advisor in a number of jobs in the Clinton administration. As you will hear, she is not now, nor has she ever been, a judge. Although there is very little doubt that Kagan will be confirmed and will serve on the High Court, there is still the confirmation process to navigate, and today's hearing began with almost every senator recognizing the deaths of two people very important in this world of politics and law, the former Senate Majority Leader, Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia, and also the death of Marty Ginsburg, the husband of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is the second woman appointed to the High Court. After his tribute to Senator Byrd, Senator Pat Leahy, Democrat of Vermont and chairman of the Judiciary Committee, offered his version of Kagan's resume and endorsed her qualifications to move on to the court.
There have been 111 justices on the Supreme Court of the United States. Only three have been women. If she is confirmed, Solicitor General Kagan will bring the Supreme Court to an historical high water mark. Elena Kagan earned her place at the top of the legal profession. Her legal qualifications are unassailable. As a student, she excelled at Princeton, Oxford, and Harvard Law School. She was a law clerk to the great Supreme Court Justice, Justice Thurgood Marshall. And I appreciate seeing Justice Marshall's son, Thurgood Marshall, in the audience here today. She worked in private practice and briefly for then Senator Biden on this committee. She taught law at two of the nation's most respected law schools. She counseled President Clinton on a wide variety of issues. She served as dean of Harvard Law School and is now the Solicitor General of the United States, sometimes referred to as the 10th Justice. I believe we're a better country for the path of excellence Elena Kagan has taken her career as a path now open to both men and women.
As the chairman of the committee and a member of the president's party, Leahy referred briefly to some of the issues that Republicans are expected to raise in these hearings, starting with Kagan's experience and her view of the law. As Kagan has never been a judge, she has no record of decisions. She's not written extensively on the law or on issues senators care about. Senator Leahy began by saying he hopes Kagan will be clear and open with members of the Senate committee on what she believes.
I will urge Solicitor General Kagan here publicly what I've urged her privately, to be open, to be responsive, to share with us, but even more importantly with the American people, her judicial philosophy, but also to assure us of her judicial independence from either the right or the left. I believe that fair-minded people will find her judicial philosophy well within the legal mainstream. I welcome questions to Solicitor General Kagan about judicial independence, but I'd urge senators on both sides to be fair. There is no basis to question her integrity. No one should presume that this intelligent woman has excelled during every part of her varied and distinguished career lacks independence. And it is essential that judicial nominees understand that as judges, they're not members of any administration. The courts are not subsidiaries of any political party or interest groups, and our judges should not be partisans. That's why the Supreme Court's intervention in the 2000 presidential election in Bush versus Gore was so jarring, and why it shook in many people's minds throughout this country the credibility of the court. That's why the Supreme Court's recent decision, Citizens United, in which five conservative justices rejected the court's own precedent, rejected the bipartisan law enacted by Congress, rejected 100 years of legal development in order to open the door for massive corporate spending on elections, was such a joke to the system. The American people live in a real world of great challenges. The Supreme Court needs to function in that real world within the constraints of our Constitution. My own state of Vermont, the 14th state in the Union, did not vote to join the Union until the year the Bill of Rights was ratified. We are cautious in Vermont. Those of us from the Green Mountain State are protective of our fundamental liberties. We understand the importance the Constitution and its amendments have had in expanding individual liberties over the last 220 years. And I hope that Elena Kagan will demonstrate through this hearing she'll be the kind of independent justice who keep faith with these principles and keep faith with the words that are inscribed in Vermont marble over the front doors to the Supreme Court. Equal justice under law.
Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican of Alabama, is the ranking Republican on the committee and the first to raise serious questions about Kagan's qualifications and experience, beginning, of course, as is the tradition on the committee, with a gracious welcome to the nominee.
Ms. Kagan, let me join Chairman Leahy in welcoming you here today. This nomination is certainly a proud day for you and your family and your friends, and rightfully so. I enjoyed very much our meeting a few weeks ago and appreciated the chance to talk with you then. Mr. Chairman, thank you for your work on this nomination. As I have pledged, Republicans are committed to conducting this hearing in a thoughtful and respectful manner. It's not a coronation, as I've said, but a confirmation process. Serious and substantive questions will be asked. Ms. Kagan will be given ample opportunity to respond. Ms. Kagan certainly has numerous talents and many good qualities, but there are serious concerns about this nomination. Ms. Kagan has less real legal experience of any nominee in at least 50 years, and it's not just that the nominee has not been a judge. She has barely practiced law and not with the intensity and duration from which I think real legal understanding occurs. Ms. Kagan has never tried a case before a jury. She argued her first appellate case just 9 months ago. While academia certainly has value, there is no substitute, I think, for being in the harness of the law, handling real cases over a period of years. What Ms. Kagan's public record does reveal is a more extensive background in policy, politics, mixed with law.
Sessions then offered a preview of the kinds of issues the committee Republicans plan to raise with the nominee.
During her White House years, the nominee was the central figure in the Clinton-Gore effort to restrict gun rights and, as a dramatic 5-4 decision today in the McDonald case shows, the personal right of every American to own a gun hangs by a single vote on the Supreme Court. Ms. Kagan was also the point person for the Clinton administration's effort to block congressional restrictions on partial birth abortions. Indeed, documents show that she was perhaps the key person who convinced President Clinton to change his mind from supporting to opposing legislation that would have banned that procedure. During her time as dean at Harvard, Ms. Kagan reversed Harvard's existing policy and kicked the military out of the recruiting office in violation of federal law. Her actions punished the military and demeaned our soldiers as they were courageously fighting for our country in two wars overseas. As someone who feels the burden of sending such young men and women into harm's way, and who spent much time drafting and redrafting legislation to ensure military recruiters were treated fairly on campus, I can't take this issue lightly. Dean Kagan also joined with three other law school deans to write a letter in opposition to Senator Graham's legislation, establishing procedures for determining who was an enemy combatant in the war on terror. She compared this legislation, which passed 84-14, to the fundamentally lawless actions of dictatorships. Most recently, the nominee served as Solicitor General for a little over a year, but her short tenure there has not been without controversy. In her first appellate argument, Ms. Kagan told the court that the speech and press guarantees in the First Amendment would allow the federal government to ban the publication of pamphlets discussing political issues before an election. I would remind my colleagues that the American Revolution was in no small part spurred by just such political pamphlets. Thomas Paine's Common Sense, to suggest that the government now has the power to suppress that kind of speech, is breathtaking.
I'm joined here in the studio by NPR's White House correspondent Ari Shapiro and by Tom Goldstein, who is the founder of SCOTUS blog and was at the hearing today. Tom, can I just start with you and ask you, what was the mood in the room?
Well, every Supreme Court confirmation is a spectacle, and the political world is only getting nastier. Today, I'd say the mood was serious, but it wasn't electric. That's probably because, as you said, she's almost certain to be confirmed. And unlike our first Hispanic justice, Sonia Sotomayor, from last year, this isn't a historic confirmation fight.
What do you think, Ari? Do you think Senator Sessions appears to be sort of saying some very negative things? Is that how should we evaluate the tone of what we hear from members in the opening statements coming up?
The things that Senator Sessions and other Republicans said today don't strike me as significantly more negative than the things I said about Sotomayor a year ago. And as you mentioned, much like with Sotomayor, there's an expectation that she will be confirmed. I think from the Republicans and from the nominee, we heard the same sorts of things in this hearing that we've heard in past hearings. What struck me as different was what the Democrats said, which I thought was to a large extent a rail against the current Supreme Court. Almost more negative rhetoric against the current Supreme Court from Democrats than against Kagan from Republicans.
So coming up, we'll listen to some of that. We'll hear what members of the committee had to say about Kagan in their opening statements, a preview of coming days. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and you are listening to a special report on the hearings on the nomination to the Supreme Court from NPR News. From NPR News in Washington, you're listening to a special report, hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the nomination of Elena Kagan to be the newest justice on the Supreme Court. I'm Linda Wertheimer. What we're going to do now is roll fairly quickly through the opening statements of many of the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Most of them talk about what their concerns are, concerns they want to raise in conversations with Kagan tomorrow and possibly the next day. You will hear the political strategies of the two parties emerge as we move from Democrats to Republicans and back again, as they telegraph what the next couple of days may be like for the nominee. Senator Herb Kohl, Democrat of Wisconsin, is the most senior member on the Democratic side after the chairman. He indicated that not all the questions coming from Democrats will necessarily be friendly. Kohl appears to have serious concerns about Kagan's qualifications.
Your judicial philosophy is almost invisible to us. We don't have a right to know in advance how you will decide cases, but we do have a right to understand your judicial philosophy and what you think about fundamental issues that will come before the court. As you said in your own critique of these hearings in 1995, it is, quote, an embarrassment that senators do not insist that a nominee reveal what kind of justice she would make by disclosing her views on important legal issues. The president has his vetting process, and we in the Senate have our vetting process, but this hearing is the only opportunity for the American public to learn who you are. They deserve to learn about your views and motivations before you don the black robes of a justice for a lifetime appointment.
Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah, who voted for Kagan to be Solicitor General, joked with her that as this is a lifetime appointment, this may be her last confirmation hearing. But then he raised questions about understanding her idea of the law.
My primary goal in this confirmation process is to get the best picture I can of General Kagan's judicial philosophy, primarily from her record, but also from this hearing as well. I have to make my decision whether to support or not support her nomination on the basis of evidence, not on blind faith. I've never considered the lack of judicial experience to be an automatic disqualifier for a judicial nominee, Approximately one-third of the 111 men and women who have served on the Supreme Court have had no previous judicial experience. What they did have, however, was an average of more than 20 years of private practice experience. In other words, Supreme Court nominees have had experience behind the bench as a judge, before the bench as a lawyer, or both. Ms. Kagan worked for 2 years in a law firm. The rest of her career is in academia and politics. As the Washington Post described it, she brings experience, quote, in the political circus that often defines Washington, unquote.
Part of the subtext here, of course, is that Elena Kagan's time in that circus was working for President Bill Clinton, a Democrat. A major part of what senators have been able to see of her record consists of emails and other communications offering advice to President Clinton on issues. Dianne Feinstein of California, a Democrat, came next and began by praising Kagan's legal qualifications as Solicitor General, as a law school dean, a theme other Democrats also sounded. But then Feinstein pointed the way that Democrats seem to be going in these hearings, charging that the current court, led by Chief Justice John Roberts, is an activist court, something that traditionally concerns Republicans. She raised today's decision by the court on gun rights.
This morning, I was extremely dismayed to learn of the court's decision in McDonald versus the City of Chicago, holding that common sense state and local gun laws across the country now will be subject to federal lawsuits. This decision and its predecessor, the District of Columbia versus Heller, have essentially disregarded the precedent of 71 years embedded in the United States v. Miller, a 1939 case. I find that shocking as a former mayor. I believe the proliferation of guns have made this nation less safe, not more safe. We now have more guns than people in this country. They are sold everywhere, on street corners, in gun shows, with no restraint whatsoever, any type of weapon. They fall into the hands of juveniles, criminals, and the mentally ill virtually every day of the year. And the Supreme Court has thrown aside seven decades of precedent to exacerbate this situation. From the documents that have been revealed thus far, I am encouraged that Solicitor Kagan holds stare decisis in high regard. We will see.
Stare decisis is a legal term. It means staying with existing precedents, especially long-standing precedents. Senator Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, returned that volley with another set of concerns about Kagan's qualifications.
Your relatively thin record clearly shows that you've been a political lawyer. Your papers from the Clinton Library have been described as, and these aren't my words, a flair for the political and a flair for political tactics. You've been described as having, quote, another quote, finely tuned political antenna and a political heart. You were involved in a number of high-profile, hot-button issues during the Clinton administration, including gun rights, welfare reform, abortion, Whitewater, and Paula Jones controversies. A review of the material produced by the Clinton Library shows that you forcefully promoted liberal positions and offered analyses and recommendations that often were more political than legal. Not only that, your Marshall memos indicate a liberal and seemingly outcome-based approach to your legal analysis. You have admitted that your upbringing steeped you in deeply held liberal principles. You should know, or we should know, whether, as you've said, you have, quote, retained them fairly intact to this date, end of quote. A judge needs to be an independent arbiter, not an advocate for a political agenda. This point is absolutely crucial for justices, since the Supreme Court isn't as constrained to follow precedent as the same extent as judges of lower courts.
And Republicans continued to hammer at Kagan on activism and experience. Senator John Kyle of Arizona, a Republican, has a number of concerns he'll obviously raise in direct questions to the nominee. He wonders if she will be the kind of justice who makes decisions based on results rather than on law. He has concerns about her experience, and he has questions about a conflict that Harvard Law School had with military recruiters.
Given this lack of experience practicing law, I was surprised that the American Bar Association awarded her a well-qualified rating, since the ABA's own criteria for a judicial nominee call for, among other things, at least 12 years' experience in the practice of law. And they mean actual practice of law, like former Justices Rehnquist and Powell. Not only is Ms. Kagan's background unusual for a Supreme Court nominee, it's not clear how it demonstrates that she has, in the president's words, a keen understanding of how the law affects the daily lives of the American people. One recent article noted that Ms. Kagan's experience draws from a world whose signposts are distant from most Americans: Manhattan's Upper West Side, Princeton University, Harvard Law School, and the upper reaches of the Democratic legal establishment. Her career in academia tells us relatively little about her views on legal issues. In 14 years as a professor, she published only 9 articles, 2 of which were book reviews, and her tenure in the academy was marred, in my view, by her decision to punish the military and would-be recruits for a policy, don't ask, don't tell, and the Solomon Amendment that was enacted by members of Congress and signed into law by President Clinton.
Senator Arlen Specter is now a Democrat from Pennsylvania, having changed parties, but when he was a Republican, he voted against Kagan's appointment to be Solicitor General. The court, he said, has become an ideological battleground, and he pointed out that what nominees have said in their confirmation hearings does not necessarily match what they do as justices. Therefore, senators may have to insist on being very clear where nominees actually stand.
We've had nominees who sat where you sit not too long ago, who said they would not jolt the system, modesty, and then a grave jolt to the system. Assure this panel that the legislative finding of facts is not a judicial function, and then turn that on its head in Citizens United on a record that is 100,000 pages long, and finding that there's no basis for a 100-year-old precedent, which was overturned. Certainly a jolt to the system. When Senator Biden was considering the nomination of Chief Justice Roberts, he said that he was qualified, but would vote against him because, as then-Senator Obama said, quote, overarching political philosophy, close quote. Well, the presidents make their selections based on ideology. I think that's a blunt fact of life. And the deference that I had considered in earlier days in the Senate, I thought, I've come to the conclusion that senators have the same standing to make a determination on ideology.
Kagan brought some of this kind of inquiry on herself. In a 1995 review of a book about the confirmation process, she noted that the exchange between members and nominees was not pointed, not a serious discussion of the law and the court's role. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, a Republican, smiled when he made this point.
Now, you're the best example I can think of why hearings should be probative and meaningful. You come with a no judicial record, but you're not the first person to come before the committee without having been a judge. But it does, I think, require us and you to provide us a little insight as to what kind of judge you would be. You have very little private practice. 1 year as Solicitor General, and a lot of my colleagues on this side have talked about some of the positions you've taken that I think are a bit disturbing, but I'd like to acknowledge some of the things you've done as Solicitor General that were, I thought, very good. You opposed applying habeas rights to Bagram detainees. You supported the idea that a terrorist suspect could be charged with material support of terrorism under the statute, and that was consistent with the law of war's history. So there are things you've done as Solicitor General that I think merit praise, and I will certainly, from my point of view, give you a chance to discuss those. As Dean of Harvard Law School, you did 2 things. You hired some conservatives, which is a good thing. And you opposed military recruitment, which I thought was inappropriate, but we'll have a discussion about what all that really does mean. It's a good example of what you bring to this hearing, a little of this and a little of that.
Back to the Democrats. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York clearly plans to take on the conservative majority now controlling the court in the next few days, despite the fact that Kagan's presence on the court, if she should be confirmed, will not change the current 5-4 voting patterns very much.
We need a justice who can create moderate majorities on this immoderate Supreme Court. I'm going to be blunt about this. We have a highly fractured court with an often rarefied way of approaching the law. The rightward shift of the court under Chief Justice Roberts is palpable. In decision after decision, special interests are winning out over ordinary citizens. In decision after decision, this court bends the law to suit an ideology. Judicial activism now has a new guise, judicial activism to pull the country to the right. These rulings have real-world consequences, make no mistake about it. They affect the remedies of women who for years earn less money than men in the same job. They undermine the rules that Congress and agencies can put in place to keep the water that we drink and the air that we breathe safe for our children, and they rent the very fabric of our democratic system.
That was Senator Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York. I'm joined now by our legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg, White House correspondent Ari Shapiro, and Tom Goldstein, who is the founder of SCOTUS blog. Now, let me just start by asking about Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall is generally spoken of in heroic terms. Today, however, we heard his name a lot in not-so-glowing terms from many Republicans on the committee. Tommy, what's that about?
Well, conservatives think that Justice Marshall, for whom Elena Kagan was a law clerk a quarter century ago, kind of epitomizes all that's wrong and too much in power grabbing of liberal justices on the Supreme Court. But they also recognize that there's a grave danger in this line of attack because, as you say, he is a hero of the civil rights movement and to the African-American community in particular.
There were some other terms that we heard today. Just to let me just ask for some help with these things. Activism, referring to the Roberts Court. Ari, what does that mean?
Right. Well, historically, we've heard activism used as a term to describe liberal judicial philosophy. Now, Democrats co-opted it to describe a conservative judicial philosophy, hammering away at the Roberts Court, calling it an activist court, and practically begging Americans to pay attention to the ways in which the court affects them. This is not going to have an impact on the short term. In all likelihood, Kagan will be a similar vote to the man she's replacing, Stevens. But in the long term, I think what we see is a strategy by Democrats to sort of wake Americans up, make them care about the court, and reframe the argument about what an activist judge is.
Another thing that Republicans were warning America about was the empathy standard.
Right, which was a term that President Obama first used more than a year ago when he was talking about his first Supreme Court nominee, Justice Sonia Sotomayor. But when Sotomayor was asked about the empathy standard, she disavowed it. When President Obama was asked about it in regard to Kagan, he dodged the question, and Kagan has said nothing about empathy, but Republicans see it as a buzzword that they keep bringing up in these hearings.
And I should say here that Chief Justice John Roberts has said privately that he has empathy for any nominee to the Supreme Court during hearings like this.
Nina, let me ask you that about a question which I have to announce a conflict. My husband was a lawyer in one of these cases. But Democrats keep bringing up Citizens United. So could you just explain what that decision was and why it's constantly referred to?
Well, this term, the Supreme Court, by a 5-4 vote, invalidated about 100 years of campaign finance law, and for the first time invalidated the long-time prescriptions on corporate and union spending in candidate elections. And so on the Republican side, they were elated about this decision. They have seen restrictions as a violation of free speech, or many Republicans have. And on the Democratic side, they were highly critical and said this was a way to undermine popular government, essentially, by selling it off to the highest bidder. So we're going to hear a lot about Citizens United, which was argued by Elena Kagan in the Supreme Court, and she lost.
There was also a major ruling on gun rights, which came down today.
Well, it's kind of interesting. In an odd sort of way, there's a connection between these two. Elena Kagan was representing not only the President of the United States, but the Congress of the United States in defending the Campaign Finance Act, which was enacted by Congress. And solicitors general are supposed to defend an act of Congress unless they think it's unconscionable. Today, the court had a major gun rights decision. And interestingly enough, the former solicitor general this time represented the NRA in opposing in taking the position of the NRA and in winning a victory in the Supreme Court. He took exactly the opposite position when he was representing the government and he had to defend federal gun laws. You represent the person you came to the party with, basically. And so to attack a solicitor general of either party for the position they took is going to be difficult, at least to sell with lawyers.
Coming up, we'll listen to the nominee herself, and I think it's fair to say that in her opening remarks, Elena Kagan gave nothing away. We'll hear that in just a bit. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and you are listening to a special report from NPR News. From NPR News in Washington, this is special coverage of the hearings on the nomination of Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Solicitor General Elena Kagan sat mostly solemn, occasionally smiling, for almost 4 hours while the senators of the Judiciary Committee talked to her and about her, and finally it was her turn.
Sister General, please stand and raise your right hand. You solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help you God.
I do.
Kagan began by thanking the people who paved the way for her, her family and her friends, and the justices who went before her, from retiring Justice John Paul Stevens to the first two women to serve on the court.
I said when the president nominated me that the two people missing were my parents. And I feel that deeply again today. My father was as generous and public-spirited a person as I've ever known. And my mother set the standard for determination, courage, and commitment to learning. My parents lived the American dream. They grew up in immigrant communities. My mother didn't speak a word of English until she went to school. But she became a legendary teacher, and my father a valued lawyer. And they taught me and my two brothers, both high school teachers, that this is the greatest of all countries because of the freedoms and opportunities it offers its people. I know that they would have felt that today, and I pray that they would have been proud of what they did in raising me and my brothers. To be nominated to the Supreme Court is the honor of a lifetime. I'm only sorry that, if confirmed, I won't have the privilege of serving there with Justice John Paul Stevens. His integrity, humility, and independence, his deep devotion to the court, and his profound commitment to the rule of law, all these qualities are models for everyone who wears or hopes to wear a judge's robe. If given this honor, I hope I will approach each case with his trademark care and consideration. That means listening to each party with a mind as open as his to learning and persuasion, and striving as conscientiously as he has to render impartial justice. I owe a debt of gratitude to two other living justices, Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, paved the way for me and so many other women in my generation. Their pioneering lives have created boundless possibilities for women in the law.
Kagan also talked about her respect for the rule of law, her respect for the court, and especially for her mentor, Justice Thurgood Marshall.
My first real exposure to the court came almost a quarter century ago when I began my clerkship with Justice Thurgood Marshall. Justice Marshall revered the court, and for a simple reason. In his life, in his great struggle for racial justice, the Supreme Court stood as the part of government that was most open to every American and that most often fulfilled our Constitution's promise of treating all persons with equal respect, equal care, and equal attention. The idea is engraved on the very face of the Supreme Court building. Equal justice under law. It means that everyone who comes before the court, regardless of wealth or power or station, receives the same process and the same protections. What this commands of judges is even-handedness and impartiality. What it promises is nothing less than a fair shake for every American.
And something that a number of the senators spoke about, Kagan also talked about her political work.
But the time I spent in the other branches of government remind me that it must also be a modest one, properly deferential to the decisions of the American people and their elected representatives. What I most took away from those experiences was simple admiration for the democratic process. That process is often messy and frustrating, but the people of this country have great wisdom, and their representatives work hard to protect their interests. The Supreme Court, of course, has the responsibility of ensuring that our government never oversteps its proper bounds or violates the rights of individuals. But the court must also recognize the limits on itself and respect the choices made by the American people.
Kagan spoke about her love of the law and her love of teaching it. She promised to approach cases with an open mind, but she said she would make no promises on issues.
I will make no pledges this week other than this one, that if confirmed, I will remember and abide by all these lessons. I will listen hard to every party before the court and to each of my colleagues. I will work hard, and I will do my best to consider every case impartially, modestly, with commitment to principle and in accordance with law. That is what I owe to the legacy I share with so many Americans. My grandparents came to this country in search of a freer and better life for themselves and their families. They wanted to escape bigotry and oppression, to worship as they pleased, and work as hard as they were able. They found in this country, and they passed on to their children and their children's children, the blessings of liberty. Those blessings are rooted in this country's Constitution and its historic commitment to the rule of law. I know that to sit on our nation's highest court is to be a trustee of that inheritance. And if I have the honor to be confirmed, I will do all I can to help preserve it for future generations. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee.
And that was it. Solicitor General Elena Kagan making her opening statement before the Senate Judiciary Committee. We expect considerable discussion with the nominee tomorrow and possibly the next day. After that, there will be panel discussions with all kinds of witnesses on issues. But the part of the hearings, of course, that we are interested in are the part that involve the nominee herself. I'm joined here in the studio today by NPR's legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg, and White House correspondent Ari Shapiro, and from the outside, thanks very much for Tom Goldstein, the founder of SCOTUS Blog, coming in. Let me just ask you, Ari, there several times there was a mention of a book review that Kagan wrote in 1995 in a law review issue. She bemoaned the lack of transparency from nominees during confirmation hearings. She basically praised the Bork hearings, which was pretty much an all knockdown, drag out fight,
right,
between Judge Bork and the Senate Judiciary Committee. She praised that as a sort of a good example of a discussion, mm-hmm, between a nominee and the committee, and not what happens now.
No, I mean, if we review the themes of her opening statement, they were humility, moderation, even-handedness. These are the exact same themes that every Supreme Court justice for the last decade, every nominee for the last decade, has mentioned, from Roberts and Alito under President Bush to Sotomayor under President Obama. And if you listen to the tone and style of her comments, she was speaking so slowly that with 30-minute rounds for questions tomorrow, I think each senator will be able to get about 3 questions in before their time is up.
The Obama White House thinks that's a way to get a nominee confirmed. They teach them to slow talk, not slow walk, slow talk.
And so the idea is, if you can say the same things that everyone else has said, be as bland and anonymous and slow as possible, then you'll get confirmed.
And so it's not do as I said in 1995. It's do what the folks in the White House are suggesting I should do now, Tom.
Well, there are very few detours on the path of Elena Kagan's professional career to the Supreme Court, but this 1995 article is certainly one of them, and it's one that she will look back on with some bemusement and maybe regret, because we haven't finished hearing about it. It will be the principal thing that the Republicans point to as Elena Kagan, if she is not entirely forthcoming, and I think she's unlikely to get into the details about how she would judge different areas of the law, they're going to point to this as a reason to oppose her, that they just don't know because she also doesn't have a track record as a judge.
Expect them to call it the Kagan standard that she's not living up to.
Now, Nina, hot button issues that she will be pressed on. Do we expect her to actually talk about anything that the senators...
Well, part of the drill, part of what they teach you in Supreme Court nominee school in Republican and Democratic White Houses is, and if the people who do this really well, like Chief Justice Roberts at his confirmation hearing, and actually David Souter did it very well at his confirmation hearing, is you go through what the considerations are and what the precedents are, but you never say how that's going to influence what you are going to do.
So
you've proved how smart you are.
We raised gun control.
Yeah, you say here's what the court, why the court came to the conclusion it did then, and of course it moderated that view a few years later, and people who are critical of it say another thing, and then you just leave it there. You don't say what you're going to do.
And so we look for that to happen.
We absolutely look for that to happen. And I think it would be very difficult for any nominee to say, gee, I've made up my mind. This is what I think. And I want to tell you that Justice Stephen Breyer has said often lately to friends, he said, you know, people are asking, what does Elena Kagan really think? I know what she thinks. And everybody looks at him and they say, well, what does she think? And he says, she doesn't know. Because until you've considered these questions as a Supreme Court justice, not a lower court judge, but a Supreme Court justice, you haven't thought it through with the kind of mindset that you are going to approach it as a Supreme Court justice.
And I think no one could accuse Elena Kagan of not being intense. So I assume that she would bring that kind of intensity to those decisions. Now, I've been saying, and I hope that I have not been misleading anybody, that she's expected to probably sail through because the Democrats have a solid majority in the Senate. But obviously, both sides are looking to make some political hay out of this moment. Ari?
Yes. Well, for the last 7 weeks, Republicans have been trying to make political hay out of this. And to a large extent, they've not been succeeding because the BP oil spill, the Afghanistan conflict, both are making more news than the hundreds of thousands of pages from the Clinton White House library about Elena Kagan have made. That said, because Kagan has so little of a track record, I think both the Republicans and the Democrats can try to push whatever political agenda they want to pursue onto this confirmation hearing. So for the Republicans, it may just be a matter of rallying the base. As Senator Lindsey Graham said in the hearing today, he's trying to get Americans to realize that elections count, and when a Democrat wins an election, somebody like Elena Kagan is going to get nominated to the court. I think Democrats are trying really hard to persuade Americans that the Supreme Court counts, and to talk about the Citizens United decision and the gun case that was handed down today that do have an impact on a large number of Americans, and sort of rally the base in that respect.
Now, Tom, the major decision today, the gun case, could you just give us a quick précis on this case?
Sure. By way of background, the conservative members of the Supreme Court held 5-4 today, building on a decision that they had issued a couple of years ago, that the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms restricts not just federal gun laws, but also state and local gun laws. The court didn't tell us how much it restricts them, but the question answer today is it does apply to them.
So that if a city has gun laws or if a state has gun laws, they might be subject to review by the Supreme Court now.
Well, that's right. There will certainly be lawsuits in federal courts and state courts because the Second Amendment, we don't know, may reach broader than gun rights that are in state constitutions. So this was a case out of the city of Chicago, which had a very rigorous registration requirement that made it extremely difficult to get a gun. And there are all kinds of gun restrictions out there. And the Supreme Court said, we're going to leave for another day what's okay and what isn't under the Second Amendment when it comes to concealed weapons, weapons in the workplace, registration, licensing requirements, and the like. And the reason it comes up in these hearings is that it's now a major hot-button social issue, of course. It became an issue in the Sonia Sotomayor hearings. It affected how many Republicans voted. And there is some slight way from a couple of things that Elena Kagan did early in her professional career to link her to the gun issue as well.
So, Nina, what does this mean that they are waiting on the Second Amendment, on how this is actually going to work?
Oh, we're not going to know before her confirmation. We're not going to know for years because the court gave really precious little guidance today. What it said, it set out a broad parameter. It said the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms applies to all gun regulations. So now, some regulations will be reasonable. Maybe even most of the ones on the books will be reasonable, but not all of them will be reasonable. What we don't know is which ones are which. And the court gave us very little in the way of guidelines, as I said, to sort of send us on our way and figure that out. And so this is going to get litigated and litigated and litigated for years to come.
But will it be something that senators will want to get an idea of where would Kagan be on this?
Yes, they'll want desperately, and she'll want desperately not to tell them. And she has all of the canons of judicial ethics to help her in that because the judges aren't supposed to prejudge questions that may come before them. And all of these are going to come before her if she's confirmed.
Let me ask you something about the court today. I mean, they made this big decision the very last day, but that wasn't all that happened. Today is the day that Justice Stevens retired. Today is also the day that everyone at the court, the reporters, the clerks, and everybody else acknowledges that Ruth Bader Ginsburg lost her husband last night.
Well, it was really an extraordinary day. I don't remember a time when we had more than an hour of opinion announcements and dissents. I wasn't even sure that Justice Ginsburg would be there. Her husband of 56 years died yesterday, and there she was announcing one of the opinions that she wrote today, one of the very important opinions that she wrote today, looking absolutely ashen-faced, but strong-voiced, and it was true grit. And there was the beguiling Justice Stevens, so beloved and so admired, who always wears a bow tie. And today, the reporters, the lawyers in the courtroom, people who come to the court regularly, many, many of them were wearing bow ties in tribute to him. It was such a combination of emotion and ceremony and humor and a feeling of the court really as a family. People don't think of it that way because they have such intense disagreements, but they do. They think of themselves as a family.
Thanks very much. Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent, and thanks to you, Ari Shapiro, who is our White House correspondent and Tom Goldstein, who is the founder of SCOTUS Blog. Thank you all very much for joining us for this, and I hope you'll all be back with us tomorrow when we will be able to hear Elena Kagan, I think, on the hot seat. We'll see how she performs when members of the Senate begin to question her on what she really believes. I'm Linda Wertheimer, and you're listening to a special report from NPR News.